Sometimes you choose courage, and at other times it's forced upon you. Courage Unraveled is a podcast series where you get to listen to insights, discussions, conversations, and stories from people from all walks of life. You'll be served with dollops of courage, resilience, and strength here. So come along and be educated and inspired. You just may find new ways to flex your own courage muscle. My name is Sana Turnock, and I'm your host. Meet Melia Brent White, a past winemaker who gained minor celebrity status in the 2000s. Find out why she decided to radically change direction and leave the wine industry and the family legacy. This decision meant setting out on her own courageous path, a path that would take Melia towards body talk, an energetic type therapy which enables Melia to communicate with the body to help it heal itself. Growing up rurally and being a bush kid, Melia never lost connection with the land. We talk wine, we talk body talk, land management, horses, health challenges, and Melia's vision. Come and join us. It's a real privilege to be able to share these inspiring podcasts of courage with you. The work undertaken takes many hours to put together and is self-funded. Become a Courage Unraveled patron on Patreon, and not only will you be supporting the podcast, you will also be helping yourself by investing in your own courage. Get access to pre-release episodes and Patreon-y specials. It's easy being a patron, and the first tiers are less than 2 coffees per month. Cultivate and flex your courage muscle by signing up for a one-to-one Grow Into My Courage program and grab your very own journal. You grow your courage muscle by activating it. Listen to the podcasts, grab yourself the courage journal, sign up to the Grow Into My Courage program, and become a patron. After this episode, head over to courageunraveled.com. It's all happening there. Grow into your courage today. Hello, Melia Brent White, and welcome to Courage Unraveled, the Rural Women series.
Thank you, Sana.
Great to have you on the show. Melia, you have a diverse work background, and the listeners will get a chance to hear your skills and talents as we move along in our conversation. You have come on the program to talk about family vision and legacy, but before we do that, let's get to know you a little bit more. You come from a rural background. Where did you grow up?
Since the 1980s, I grew up in rural Yelling Up, which was sheep country back then. The wine industry was in its infancy. There was only a smattering of vineyards in the area. So it was quite a different place to live than what it is now.
What was your role when you were a kid growing up there?
So I grew up on a couple of different properties, one in rural Willyabra, a couple in rural Yelling Up. And because it was so isolated back then, We would play on the land. My brother's 22 months younger than me, and we would go and we'd be catching jilgies and leeches in the dam, roaming over the property, rescuing orphan lambs, basically just exploring. I remember once with my horse, I went exploring the local carry forest for 8 hours.
So wow. On your own, or do you and your brother?
It was with a neighbour. We went by horseback. Okay. That was a pretty regular thing for us to do, just to go. Very different to how a lot of children grow up these days, but with a lot of freedom. I really appreciate that now, looking back retrospectively.
Sounds fantastic. For those people who don't know about Yelling Up and who may not be West Australian, now it's this part of the world where it's this little nugget of gold. It's been carved up into 5-acre properties and it's wine country.
Yeah, and people do know about it globally now. Before, they never, ever did.
It's tiny. It's so tiny, really. And it's won Australia's prettiest town of the year at one point, I think it was. It won some kind of accolade like that.
I didn't know about that, but for good reason. Okay. You can see, I don't really want to advertise it too heavily.
That's right. You want to keep it small.
But it is a very special part of the world.
Yes. Okay. I will scrap that. You can come and visit, folks, but you just can't live here. Okay, let's move forward as you, Melia, an adult, because your family did purchase land to develop a winery. Is that right?
I'm lucky enough to have had a very dynamic and visionary grandmother. She had the vision to purchase I think, 3 or 4 different properties in Yallingup in the 80s and the 90s. So that property that got developed has been developed into a vineyard by my parents, did originally come through my grandmother, and another property that she purchased as well was developed into another vineyard by my uncle. So, yeah, it's wonderful that Gran could see that potential and purchase those properties, because not everyone appreciated the value of the area at the time.
That is wisdom, isn't it? That's fantastic. So as an adult, you joined the family for the vision. Your role there was as a viticulturalist and a winemaker, is that right?
Yes, I went travelling overseas for many years, and then I wanted to come back and go to uni, and I was looking at employment future potential for the area. Basically, it was winemaking or hospitality. So I decided to study winemaking, have a degree of applied science in viticulture and enology. And after graduating from uni, I went and I worked in quite a few different countries, including New Zealand, France, and I went to South Australia as well before coming back to work for my family. When I worked for my family, I was doing lots of different aspects of the business, working in the vineyard as well as working in sales. And then I'd go and work for another company in a winemaking aspect.
What did you learn by traveling to all different countries of the world and then coming back to Yallingup? What kinds of things could you bring to the table, so to speak?
I had the fortunate opportunity to work with a family in Saint-Emilion in France, and they had a 400-year-old legacy with their family wine business. So I lived with them and I learned quite a lot about their winemaking production techniques, but also their philosophy to food and the land. They were very much focused on quality and simplicity. That was a really beautiful thing to experience, as well as being welcomed into their family. I got to live with them for quite a few months, as well as work for them. And traveling to other areas in New Zealand, what really highlighted to me was the wine industry has a very green label. A lot of people perceive it as very green, but I could see that there was a lot of environmental destruction happening as well. And that's one thing that really impacted me when I came back, was wanting to do things in a sustainable way, but had less chemical inputs and stuff like that with land management. Unfortunately, while I worked for my family, that wasn't an option, but that current winery now is organic. It's been certified organic from my sister and her husband, who took over the vineyard after I left.
So you came back and you had perhaps these ideas that you wanted to implement, but the family wasn't open to it at that point in time, or they didn't have the resources to do that?
This is where the courage part comes in, because I know that a lot of other people that come from rural and farming legacy and heritage can come up against similar things, where there's a way that's been done, a way of land management that works and it's profitable. But then coming in with different ideas and different ways, you often do come up against that old guard. At the time, it wasn't feasible to transition over, and also it was something, I was a single person at the time, it wasn't something that I could fully take on either. So in the end, my health was really poor and I left the family business after working very hard for about 4 or 5 years in the family business before deciding that it wasn't something that I could continue doing sustainably.
When you talk about the old guard, you talk about your family having particular ways in which they wanted to run things, and your ideas weren't welcomed, I gather, or were they kind of butting against your ideas? Is that pretty much what you're saying?
I guess it comes down to relationship challenges as well. It's a complicated answer to that one, Sana. I guess in ways I was being told that I was going to inherit the farm and in charge of management. That was what was being said, but I didn't actually have any of that responsibility. My parents weren't willing to hand over that at that time.
Sure. You had all these ideas in your mind and then you kept on coming up against the old guard. And then you're talking about your health. So was it clear to you at the time that your health was suffering because of this, or were there other things at play?
It was a combination of things. I know exactly what it was now. At the time, I didn't. I pushed myself too far in 2008, 4 vintages in 14 months, which is a really crazy thing to do. So vintage is the winemaking harvest, and this is working in various wineries. And you're working 6-7 days a week for 12 hours. So I pushed myself too far and I really kind of flicked a switch that particular year in 2008, just from trying to get too much done too soon. And in retrospect, that was a really silly thing. I've learned a lot from it, but if I could turn back one thing, I'd turn back that. At the time, I also had met someone while I was in New Zealand, and the relationship didn't work out, so there was a lot of emotional trauma associated at that time as well, and it turned into a lot of internal destruction. That internal destruction kind of continued with me for the time that I was working for my family, and I have my own ideas. I am quite strong in personality, but in that scenario, working for family, I had to defer every decision. And in retrospect, that was very damaging to me as well, because I have to be true to myself. And when I'm not true to myself, my body kicks up a big stink.
And that's what you found. Was there an inner knowing that you thought, I actually have to leave the farm for the sake of my health? Or was it circumstances that led you down that path?
I think the vintage before, I remember speaking to a colleague saying, I have to leave winemaking. I have to stop doing vintage. My body just can't take it. It turns out I'm quite allergic to sulfur. Ended up at the state where I had rashes on 80% of my torso, as well as extreme fatigue. So not being able to work through a whole day. In the end, I did give notice. I think it was April 2012 when I gave notice to my family and for leaving August 2012, and surprisingly a month after I gave notice to my family, I met my current husband, and I'd been single for 11 years, so it was interesting how that all turned out. But yeah, my health was really bad, and it got worse actually after I left. When I met my husband, I was actually at my lowest. I think our first date, I had migraines and I was vomiting. Yeah, there was lots of that going on. So good on him for sticking in there, because it wasn't a pretty scenario. The signs were not looking good, but luckily love was there.
Love prevailed.
It did.
That's a good story. Talking about love, you were wanting to find someone at one stage, and so you stepped up and signed up for the TV series A Farmer Wants a Wife, right? That was in 2009. And I guess my question is, was this something you actually wanted to do or had to build up enough courage to try out for?
In winter 2009, I was pruning in the vineyard with my dad and another friend of the family that would prune. It's a pretty lonely thing, Sana. Every day of winter in the rain. Luckily, I had electric secateurs, so that makes the job a little bit easier. Yeah, so you're just like listening to podcasts every day and you're just pruning. So that was, I think, my third or the fourth year of pruning in the winter time. And I'd come home by myself. I was living by myself, and I think I saw the ad on TV and I was like, I knew I needed a partner to take the business over. I couldn't do it by myself. I knew that, and I needed support. So that was how that all came about. I did apply and they did accept me to go on the show as a female farmer. But it was funny because the candidates that came, I remember, came to the house because they came and stayed for, I think, 10 days. I was with the director and associate producer, and I had to cook them dinner. We filmed part of it. Those boys, not one of them picked up their plate and went to help us tidy. They didn't help anything. It was like they were on holiday.
What the heck?
I immediately thought, these aren't the right guys for me. I basically need someone who can do 50-50 and who kind of has the nous to help out, especially if I'm kind of carrying on a business and I'm actively working. So yeah, poor guys didn't really stand a chance from that minute. That was from day one. That was the death knell. And I actually went to the producers and I said, look, the writing's on the wall with these guys.
And they still wanted to actually run with the show.
We did carry through with it, yeah. That was kind of my choice, and I did probably go against myself a bit to carry through it. But anyway, my current husband, he's very helpful around the house, so I did end up finding what I wanted. But yeah, seems like men that do dishes can be sometimes a little bit hard to find.
Oh, that's amazing. I watched some of the footage and you seemed pretty clear at the time as to the kind of person you wanted. The person that you married, are they a farmer?
Not at all, no. He's from Campbelltown in New South Wales, but he's good at learning things.
I know, he's good at media.
And he's becoming more and more rural as our relationship develops, so we'll get him there.
You mentioned earlier, Amelia, about going against yourself in the program A Farmer Wants a Wife, because you found that whenever you do that, things don't work out well for you. Walk us through a little bit about what happened during the filming of A Farmer Wants a Wife.
I work with trained intuition now, and I can see in retrospect that there was a lot of signs saying, hey, stop sign. When I initially went over east, I actually developed a corneal ulcer. So during all the promo photos and the first day of filming, I was in absolute agony and had to pretend that everything was okay. It was like I was being stabbed in the eye with a knife. It was really quite a horrible thing. And then I had to go swimming during it as well. And that was agony because we had a surfing lesson. And then when I was hosting the boys over here, they all went surfing. It injured up and one of them busted his collarbone. And he was the one that I was probably most interested in of all of them. And then a horse got injured during it as well, cut its leg up on wire. So there was quite a lot of different things that were telling me, maybe rethink what's going on here. I was 30 at the time. I'm 40 now. So it was a time when I was going against myself, like perhaps didn't know myself and perhaps following other people's lead or what I thought was best for me rather than what I know is best for me. So, and my body kicked up a big, big fuss. I could have almost become legally blind when I didn't realize what was going on with my eye at the time. And with the filming, I didn't really get proper care either. They just kept on putting things in my eye just to help with the redness. But when I went and got it looked at by an ophthalmologist, they said, oh my goodness, if this scarring was any more, you would have been blind. So yeah, that was a pretty big lesson for me.
Definitely. And then earlier you spoke about getting unwell when you were working on the farm, winemaking and putting those crazy hours for the vintage seasons. When you made that decision, what kind of inner dialogue were you having when you knew you had to have a family conversation about that decision?
The way I describe it, and sometimes I describe it to other people that I work with these days as well, sometimes the writing's on the wall and you just have to turn your head and look at it. It's kind of there in the background. The writing on the wall was, you can't continue. It was quite a strong feeling that I couldn't continue. It was not a beneficial path for me mentally or physically. And that was also to do with probably my own way of managing myself and my habits. At the time, I was partying a bit as well and drinking and having rich meals. I became quite good friends with some of the male farmers from the show. So I did have quite a few fun times with them, but that wasn't beneficial for my health. They're all party animals, really. Lots and lots of fun. Really lovely guys. I would have probably have liked to have hooked up with one of them, but we both had legacy stuff going on as well. And a lot of those guys that I know, they had to leave the farm or another child inherited it. Perhaps the one thing that kind of bound us all together was that we wanted to get away. Which the filming gave us an excuse to actually leave the farm and go and have a really good time.
You all needed a break. Except for you, because you were cooking. You were cooking for them.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh.
That were the boys that came. The other farmers were different. They had girls that went to their farms.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. Okay. So there was like seven of us and we were called the farmers, except I was a woman. People would apply to have dates with the farmers and then you would have, I think, 10 speed dates or whatever, and then you chose three of them to come back to your place. So that was over in Sydney. Filming overall took about 30 days. And then so from the three at your place, you had to send people home. I didn't get that choice because someone broke their collarbone and they had to go home. And then you had to choose one by the end and then you meet up again in Sydney. So that's the format of the show.
You knew that one that you liked who broke his collarbone, he was out, so...
It turns out he was a comedian, a misogynistic comedian. He went on the show for airtime. I wouldn't say I was so romantically interested in him, but he was the one that I could relate to the most. But one of the guys from South Australia, like the other farmer, he was pretty cute. So I would say that I had a bit of a crush on him. But he was also a bit of a party animal. Sometimes they work for like 24 hours straight on those headers. Farmers are a different type, that's for sure.
Yeah, they need to let their hair down. Let's go back to you having to make your decision and the dialogue that was going on internally for you at the time. Did you need to build up the courage to talk to them about it?
I probably did, Sana. I can't quite remember. I don't remember it was an easy thing. I think it was a really difficult thing. I think it actually caused my parents quite a lot of hurt. I still have some kind of ricochets from that decision. I don't know if they understood that I didn't have many other choices at the time, but it was at the point where I basically had to make that decision to leave and to leave their vision as well in order to find what my own vision was. So that's where the courage really was actually asking myself what I wanted from life, and if I wasn't going to follow someone else's vision, what was I going to do?
I know that you're a body talker these days, so when did body talk appear in your life? Was it around that time when you let go of everything and surrendered?
I took 6 months off work after leaving the family business, and I thought, well, I've got to retrain. I spent a lot of time and energy building up my profile and work in the wine industry. At the point of leaving, actually, I had been asked to be an associate judge at the Margaret River Wine Show, which was the next kind of level that I'd been working towards. I'd been stewarding for quite a few years, and then you need to get an invitation. And I really knew that it was a death knell when I turned that invitation down and said I couldn't do it. And so I left, and then I had 6 months off, and that's when I met my partner. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I thought I wanted to retrain to work in the horse industry because horses had always been my passion. But it was around that time that I did study like a body talk for animals, access for animals course, and then I had a body talk session from the instructor, and my body responded really well. I decided, well, I don't really know what that is, but I'm going to study that because my body responds really well to it.
Body talks are quite a complex healing modality to explain. Could you provide a simple overview for the listener as to what it is?
So it's a way of restoring communication within the body. When there's problems with health, it's due to communication breakdown, whether it's through the mental body, the physical body, or the energy body. And so with body talk, we're looking at highlighting and restoring that communication. So we point things out and the person's body does its own healing work.
And the healing doesn't necessarily come immediately because it takes time for the assimilation of what you do to help the repair process, I guess, or the healing and the repair process take place. Is that fair to say?
Definitely. Some people notice things straight away, and sometimes it can be a much slower process. I do find a lot of people forget the way that they were. So until I kind of remind them, they don't actually acknowledge their own healing and their own process. One thing I would say is that healing doesn't work like how we think it works. It works a little bit differently, and body talk is a balancing system. So it's actually about finding more balance or improving the balance point within the body and the mind. People have to learn that about themselves, what it feels like to be balanced, what it feels like to not be balanced. I really know what it feels like not to be balanced. I push it to the extreme, which is quite useful to know that as a practitioner, because then I can recognize certain traits in others.
Definitely, yes. I guess you can say, look, I've been down that end of the spectrum. You don't want to go there. Or if you do, it's not pretty.
I've had full adrenal fatigue and a lot of kind of chronic fatigue states, a lot of mental health issues, depression, anxiety. If I could have one message to the world, it would be don't spend all the juice in your tank. Don't burn the candle at both ends. Sometimes some candles burn quicker. Like for me, I was trying to keep up with my friends and they could get away with much more than what I could get away with in terms of drinking alcohol or partying or staying late or even working crazy hours. We have this kind of work hard, party hard culture in Australia sometimes, but I definitely couldn't get away with that lifestyle, not for more than doing it for a couple of years. I actually didn't start drinking alcohol very much till I was 24, so I was a late starter. Just keep an eye on your body, and if you think you're burning it a bit fast, find ways to slow it down, because it's all about sustainability and making sure that you've got enough money in the bank or juice in the tank for when you're older. Because when there's 10 cents left, often this is what I describe to people when I'm working with fatigue. It's like, you've only got 10 cents left in the bank. And when you try to put the throttle on and you got no oomph, you've got to learn how to make 10 cents sustainable. You've got to learn to start that savings program from an energy perspective, because it just can't continue like that.
It's a very good analogy. You love horses, and from time to time you incorporate them into the healing therapeutic work that you do with humans. How do people respond to horses with what you've just been talking about? Do they help put juice back in the tank, for example?
They definitely can, and they have a electromagnetic field with their heart, which extends 3 meters out each side. So when we're in their presence, that does help us with our own heart coherence and our own rhythm and regulation. But what I found with my horses would be I would be very tired from working with people, and then I'd go and see them and they would fill me up. I would feel a bit energized, but I had to learn to find that better balance within myself instead of relying on them to kind of prop me up, because it's unfair to them. It can cause a little bit of wear and tear for them. I did study many other healing modalities with horses to learn to give more back for them as well. So I did fulfill my dream of working with horses, but I didn't continue with it. I studied equine massage, equine red light therapy. I studied saddle fitting. I went to full horse dissections, and then I trained in equine assisted learning, which is kind of the horses assisting with people learning about themselves. And what I came to the conclusion was it actually took me too much energy to continue doing that work as well, and I really had to kind of withdraw to something that was sustainable. So now I'd mainly just do the body talk, and then sometimes the equine assisted learning work comes through in workshops with people and horses.
Well, I have to say I have had experience with equine assisted learning from a therapeutic point of view. It's just amazing. The technique is so simple, isn't it? It's really about allowing us to just be still and tuning in. That's essentially what I found it to be.
Yeah, and also this is where courage comes in. It does test me regularly, especially when I'm working in that field. You open the space for the horses to co-create with you and the client. The horses have their own thing going on. I work with the horses and I'm following the horses, but the horses are actually leading and guiding sessions, and they're doing pretty profound energy and mental work with the people. My job is to facilitate that through a process of gentle inquiry while also providing that safety container to allow the interaction without controlling it too much. This is kind of where you have to open into that void of creation where you go, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what the outcome is, but I'm going to open up to it. And that also does apply to my body talk work as well. The only thing is the horses, there can be safety issues. That's very much in my mind when I'm running that work with body talk. It's just me and the client and the body talk opening up. So it's a little bit different, but both of them do require great courage because you're opening up to an unknowing.
Absolutely. And also, I guess, for the person who's doing it, they have to trust you and the work that you do, because you're saying what you do is unknown to you, and therefore they have to trust the process, don't they? It really is about profound trust and vulnerability, which lends itself back to courage.
Yeah, it really does. And I find that's part of the person's journey towards developing that level of trust within themselves. Sometimes when people show up for a body talk session and they don't know very much about it, but they've kind of followed this guidance, perhaps there's some seed within them that's going, this is the right thing for me. And they've followed that. That is development of that level of self-trust and having the courage to connect with your own inner GPS and to follow what feels right for you. And that's something that we can optimize and work on as well.
I love the way you put that. Follow your own inner GPS for the 21st century
yes.
Millennials who can relate to that. Let's pivot here. I want the listener to get this culmination of you, because you're a kid of the land, you're a rural kid, you've worked with horses, been into viticulture and been a winemaker. And one of the things that you kind of want to do is move into working with the land a bit more, but your whole life, that's kind of what you've been doing, but in different ways. I find it amazing that your life has had such a strong connection to land. When you walk the earth on Wadandi country, that's where you live, right? Do you get a sense of anything?
I definitely do, Sana. When I was a child, about once a year, I'd get overwhelmed by this sadness. This kind of really deep, depressive sadness would come across me. And I remember even hiding in a cupboard and just bawling my eyes out. And I never knew where this sadness came from or what it was. But I've realized now that I would hear the land crying, and that's what I was tuning into. So this is something that's really guided my life, particularly towards finding balance more within us, but balance between us in relationship to the environment. How can we live as humans without causing destruction to the land? It's kind of like this abusive relationship we have with our mother that sustains us, and yet we do practices that aren't very honoring to our mother. somehow finding a balance between keeping horses on this land. It's one of the hardest places in the world to keep horses from a mineral perspective. It's very depleted. It's very fragile soil. Yet the Wurundjeri people lived here very healthily. How did they do that? Like for 40,000 years. So we come in and we see from a European perspective, this is very depleted. A lot of the land's quite sandy or different soil types. Yet the land's got its own intelligence and it's got its own ecosystems and its own structures, and it's trying to find that balance between living here while respecting the land. And that's something that I can do when I'm in charge of something. I won't say in control because I'm not in control, but I have this conflict inside myself because we have this concept of land ownership, and it does feel really wrong to me from a heart perspective, yet it's the world that we live in. We put up fences which block off free flow of all the native animals, and we dam the water. So there's a lot of kind of colonialism aspects to land ownership. Yet it's the world that we live in. So it's kind of trying to find the balance between that, which is my heritage as well. I'm seventh generation West Australian from colonials that came to WA, while also respecting the land, the animals, the plants, the trees, and also the Wurundjeri people as well.
Where do you hope your connection to the land, all that you've spoken about now, will take you as far as your work goes?
I have this vision, and we're talking about me as a person of the land, and I walk the land and trees talk to me and animals talk to me, but I'm currently actually landless because we sold our place in Yallingup and we're looking to purchase land. So I'm just waiting for the old, what I'm seeking is seeking me. I'm waiting for the piece of land to say, we're looking for you too. And it's really funny because a piece of land that we passed up buying in August, a French couple bought it, and I want to create a healing center and do kind of nature tourism. And she's looking for people to lease the land. I met with her and she said, I want to do nature tourism. And so the land has its own ideas about what it wants. And our ideas, this person and myself, had a lot of similarities. I said, I could facilitate that for you. So we'll see what happens with that piece of land. But yes, the land has its own intelligence and we all live on it and develop that deeper relationship with it if we kind of go into that. So I'm looking for the right place to build this center of healing. And my concept is to really heal ourselves. We need to do this with relationship with the land and the microbes on the land and the plants and the animals, and as well as ourselves. It's us in relationship with the whole environment, not just healing from a supplement perspective or doing some mental health work. I see it as a much bigger thing, and that thing is big. It's big when I look at the vision. It's huge. It's like a puzzle, but I'm very, very close for everything falling together, and I've been working on it for about 8 years now.
What you've just described there, it's really taking holism to a new level. It's at the core, isn't it? It's not just about you healing yourself. It's your relationship to land, your relationship to country. It's funny, I remember being away from Australia for a couple of years when I was travelling, and I came back and, oh man, you know, when you go to Belmont Airport in Perth, let me tell you, I was so happy to be standing on Australian soil, despite it being tarmac. I just was thrilled that I was back home, and then to be able to look around, look outside the windows of the car and just see the landscape that I was familiar with. It was in my blood. I really felt it was in my blood, and I wanted very much, maybe from that point on a bit later in life, to live in the country. I just had that feeling just surging through my veins. So it's, you know, this relationship that we all have to land. Now, I guess some of us are more connected to it than others. One thing that I remember reading was with our Indigenous folks, and I'm not sure whether this is across all Indigenous groups or not, but if they're unwell, they go back to country. They go back to heal or they go back to die.
Yeah. And one thing that I feel like a lot of Indigenous people are still very connected to country, but the fact that they're not allowed to walk because we have fences and this land ownership concept. I know that my vision's going to challenge me a lot and challenge a lot of cultural beliefs and colonialism beliefs as well, but that's something that I'm willing to enter into as well. It's not something that I just want to spiritually bypass through, because there's a lot of richness there in terms of actually walking the talk through finding more balance in many different ways, even with native foods, as well as just going deeper. What I see when I kind of look at our relationship with the land is our culture kind of sits on the surface. When Europeans came to Australia, to WA, we look with European eyes, and that's the heritage that I've inherited. It's like I have my European eyes and my way of looking at the land. It's almost like Australia's never enough. We want things greener. We want things more fertile. We're not necessarily seeing it with our heart. We're not fully connecting with the magnificence of it. Unless you truly look at the bush, you don't see all the different colours of green that are there. But when you really look and you really start to see, you start to get this deeper relationship with the land. And I think it doesn't end. It's something to continually enter into kind of every day of our lives. And we'd never probably get there, but it's like actually being able to sink in and settle into place and go, well, my genetics might be European, but my heart lives here. And how can I create a balance between the two so that I can actually live here and live in harmony with the place where I'm residing?
To me, that's about really connected to your spirit, the spirit within yourself, to the spirit of the land. When people talk about connecting to the environment, they sometimes don't talk about the spiritual aspect because it's too woo-woo. But I think it doesn't have to be woo-woo. It's understanding that you are a speck in this life that we have and in this macrocosm of life that we're a part of for a very short period of time. And then we leave and our future generations will take it up and so on. I think we just need to continue with that understanding. It doesn't necessarily have to be any further than that, although that in itself can be quite deep.
My understanding, and I'm happy to be corrected if, you know, not quite right, but my understanding was that the relationship the land had with the Indigenous people, they were mother and child, and child and mother, kind of this symbiotic relationship of connection and tending and walking that was disrupted because of settlement. That's part of when I was hearing the land crying. It was crying like a baby because it wasn't being tended, like the energy wasn't being put in back into the ley lines, just because it wasn't for one of the Indigenous people not wanting to do it. It's just that they were moved around and put in settlements and there was discontinuation. So if we can learn with open hearts and learn how we can feed the land better energetically, but also from all the science that we know about the microbiome and the mycelium networks and trees and different pastures and crops and stuff like that.
You've got a big, big job ahead of you, but a good one, It's going to be, you know, it's like your purpose, isn't it? Coming together, yes. Your vision and your purpose coming together. All right. I have three questions that I usually ask people when they come to the program. The first one is, define courage for me, Amelia.
I see courage as the conviction to follow your own truth.
You've done a bit of that, haven't you?
Yes. And I wouldn't say it's been easy.
I don't think following your own truth is. I think it's actually quite a hard thing to do.
Yeah, and I'd say that I get challenged on a regular basis as well. It's very easy to kind of choose an easier path.
Yep, absolutely. Charles Massey is someone you describe as being courageous. Could you let the listener know who Charles Massey is and how he's influenced your life?
He's a regenerative agriculture farmer, and he was a traditional farmer. And then he decided that there was different ways of going about things, and he actually completely rehabilitated his land. He wrote a book called The Call of the Reed Warbler. You know, being from a traditional farming background, he copped a lot of flack, but he's someone who's very strongly spoken about his beliefs of relationship to land, and the proof has totally been in the pudding in terms of how he's managed his land, the productivity of his land. It can be a slower process because it can take time to shift the different methods, but I really admire him for that courage and for also leading others. He's very much a leader in the regenerative agriculture movement within Australia.
What are you going to adopt, do you think, by learning what you've learned from him?
There's quite a lot of regenerative agricultural practices and knowledge. When I was still in the wine industry, there was a guy that was from Colorado that came to visit Margaret River, and he was right into sheep grazing. And I learned a lot from him about cross-grazing species on the land. You can cross-graze up to 6 different species, including native species, to help the land. And that's one thing from the regenerative agriculture practices that I'll be using.
This is when you have your centre up and running.
Yes.
I like it. The final question. Are you courageous, Amelia?
I would say I'm very courageous. It might not necessarily look like it on the outside, but have the heart of a lion.
I like it. I like it a lot. Thank you so much, Amelia, for being on Courage Unraveled today. I really appreciate you spending time with me. Hopefully we'll get to chat again soon.
Thank you, Sana.
I find it utterly fascinating how someone's life can take them on an amazing journey, and then they find themselves back to where they started, but more enriched and wise by life's lessons. This is certainly the case with Melia, to my mind anyway. It takes so much courage to walk away from a family legacy to make it on your own, and in this case, in an industry so left afield that you end up walking a solitary path. If there's one takeaway from this conversation, it's to have the courage to make radical changes in your life. It may get messy and super uncomfortable for a while, but you learn a lot about yourself. To find out more about Melia Brent-White and her Body Talk offerings, you can find her details in the show notes. Jump onto courageunraveled.com/podcasts and search Series 5, Episode 27. For one-to-one courage mindset coaching, courage mindset group coaching, or keynote speaker inquiries, send me an email via the website. If you like what you hear, please don't forget to listen and subscribe via your favourite listening platform. And hey, I'd love to get a review from you too. I'm Sana Turnock, your Courage Unraveled host. Until next time.